9. Shocking the conscience. There is no more sacred military space than room 2E924 of the Pentagon, a windowless and secure vault of a conference room where the Joint Chiefs of Staff meet regularly to wrestle with classified matters. Its more common name is the tank. It got its name from the Joint Chiefs' original meeting location during World War II, in the basement of a federal building on Constitution Avenue in Washington, where attendees had to walk through an austere arched portal with exposed wires that gave the impression of entering a tank. Unlike the command centers conjured in Hollywood thrillers, the tank at the Pentagon resembles a small corporate boardroom, with mid-century stylings, including a gleaming golden oak table and leather swivel armchairs. The room, saturated by history, also is known as the Gold Room for its thick carpeting and ornate drapery. Uniformed officers think of the tank a bit like a church. Inside its walls, flag officers observe a reverence and decorum for the wrenching decisions that have been made here. To sit at its table is a great honor. The room is controlled by 4-star generals, not the president's civilian appointees, and it is a safe space for them to speak candidly without intrusions from the political dramas of the day. The tank is reserved for serious discussions of military tactics. Here is where matters of war and peace are determined, where the Joint Chiefs decide to send young men and women to their deaths. Hanging prominently on one of the walls, along with the American flag and the banners of the military branches, was The Peacemakers, a painting that depicted a historic meeting of a president and his 3 service chiefs, an 1865 Civil War strategy session with President Abraham Lincoln, Lieutenant General Ulysses S. Grant, Major General William Tecumseh Sherman, and Rear Admiral David Dixon Porter. 152 years after Lincoln hatched plans to preserve the Union, President Trump's advisors staged an intervention inside the tank to preserve the world order. The July 20, 2017 meeting in the tank has been documented numerous times, most memorably by Bob Woodward in Fear. But subsequent reporting reveals a more complete picture of the moment and the chilling effect Trump's comments and hostility had on the nation's military and national security leadership. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, Director of the National Economic Council Gary Cohn, and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson had grown alarmed over the first 6 months of the Trump administration by gaping holes in the president's knowledge of history and of the alliances forged in the wake of World War II that served as the foundation of America's strength in the world. Trump had unnerved trusted friends by dismissing existing relations with Western democracies as worthless, including by questioning the value of NATO while cultivating friendlier ones with Russia and other authoritarian regimes. He wanted to tear up trade deals to squeeze more out of partners, and he advocated withdrawing troops not only from active theaters like Afghanistan, but also from strategic outposts like South Korea, where U.S. forces were helping keep the peace, complaining that the military presence around the world was a waste of billions of dollars. Trump organized his unorthodox worldview under the simplistic banner of America First. But Mattis, Tillerson, and Cohn feared his proposals were rash, barely considered, and a danger to America's superpower standing. They also felt that many of Trump's impulsive ideas and their continuing difficulty communicating U.S. interests abroad with the president stemmed from his lack of familiarity with U.S. history and even with the map of the world. Cohn had confided to his peers he had been surprised at the many gaps in Trump's understanding of world affairs. To have a useful discussion with him, the trio agreed, they had to lay a foundation with Trump and create a basic knowledge a shared language. So, on July 20th, Mattis invited Trump to the tank for what he, Tillerson, and Cohn had carefully organized as a tailored tutorial on the state of the world and America's interests abroad. The meeting was billed as a briefing on Afghanistan because Trump was in the midst of developing a long-term strategy to defeat the Islamic State there. But in reality, the session was to be a gentle lesson on American power, with the president as a student. The organizers viewed it as a course correction, an intervention to educate Trump and give him some fundamentals for analyzing the world. The tank was selected as the venue because Trump was impressed by the room when he first visited it in January 2017, telling advisors that it was cool and classic, a relic from an earlier era. He marveled at the idea that he, Donald Trump, sat in the same room where commanders-in-chief before him had drawn up war plans. If it hadn't been across the Potomac River in Virginia and such a schlep from the White House, Trump would have liked to have held all his national security meetings there. On July 20th, just before 10 a.m. on a scorching summer Thursday, Trump arrived at the Pentagon. He stepped out of his motorcade, walked along a corridor with portraits honoring former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and stepped inside the tank. The uniformed officers greeted their commander-in-chief. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Joseph Dunford, sat in the seat of honor midway down the table, because this was his room, and Trump sat at the head of the table, facing a projection screen. Mattis and the newly confirmed Deputy Defense Secretary, Patrick Shanahan, sat to the president's left, with Vice President Pence and Tillerson to his right. Down the table sat the leaders of the military branches, along with Cohn and Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin. Steve Bannon was in the outer ring of chairs with other staff, taking his seat just behind Mattis and directly in Trump's line of sight. At one end of the room, opposite Trump, an opaque screen hung on the wall for the slide projections to come, with another sliding screen showing maps of different parts of the world. Mattis, Cohn, and Tillerson and their aides decided to use maps, graphics, and charts to tutor the president, figuring they would help keep him from getting bored. In his regular intelligence briefings, Trump would ravenously ingest glinting nuggets and latch onto names he recognized or hotspots he knew from the news, but he would not read written materials or have the patience for lectures. So his briefers would huddle around the Resolute desk and show Trump maps and charts and pictures and videos, as well as killer graphics, as CIA Director Mike Pompeo described them. One surefire way to get Trump's attention, they found, was to feature his name somewhere in the text. That's our task, right? To deliver the material in a way that he can best understand the information we're trying to communicate, Pompeo said. Mattis opened the July 20th tank meeting with a slideshow, sprinkled with charts and maps and punctuated by lots of dollar signs. Mattis devised a strategy to use terms the impatient president, schooled in real estate, would appreciate to impress upon him the value of U.S. investments abroad. He sought to explain why U.S. troops were deployed in so many regions and why America's safety hinged on a complex web of trade deals, alliances, and bases across the globe. Normally, trade wouldn't be considered relevant to a national security briefing, but Trump, unlike past presidents, directly connected trade agreements and treaties with foreign countries to the overall power dynamic. To Trump, America's economic power was part of its military might. If another country was imposing tariffs on U.S. goods, he reasoned, it was taking advantage of and disrespecting the United States, and therefore should lose the security blanket that U.S. troops provided. An opening line flashed on the screen, setting the tone. The post-war international rules-based order is the greatest gift of the greatest generation. Mattis then gave a 20-minute briefing on the power of the NATO alliance to stabilize Europe and keep the United States safe. Bannon thought to himself, not good. Trump is not going to like that one bit. The internationalist language Mattis was using was a trigger for Trump. Oh, baby, this is going to be fucking wild, Bannon thought. If you stood up and threatened to shoot Trump, he couldn't say post-war rules-based international order. It's just not the way he thinks. For the next 90 minutes, Mattis, Tillerson, and Cohn took turns trying to emphasize their points, pointing to their charts and diagrams. They showed where U.S. personnel were positioned at military bases, CIA stations, and embassies, and how U.S. deployments fended off the threats of terror cells, nuclear blasts, and destabilizing enemies in places including Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, the Korea Peninsula, and Syria. Cohn spoke for about 20 minutes about the value of free trade with America's allies, emphasizing how he saw each trade agreement working together as part of an overall structure to solidify U.S. economic and national security. Trump appeared peeved by the schoolhouse vibe, but also allergic to the dynamic of his advisors talking at him. His ricocheting attention span led him to repeatedly interrupt the lesson. He heard an advisor say a word or phrase and then seized on that to interject with his take. For instance, the word base prompted him to launch in to say how crazy and stupid it was to pay for bases in some countries. Trump's first complaint was to repeat what he had vented about to his national security advisor months earlier. South Korea should pay for a $10 billion missile defense system that the United States built for it. The system was designed to shoot down any short and medium-range ballistic missiles from North Korea, to protect South Korea and American troops stationed there. But Trump argued that the South Koreans should pay for it, proposing that the administration pull U.S. troops out of the region or bill the South Koreans for their protection. We should charge them rent, Trump said of South Korea. We should make them pay for our soldiers. We should make money off of everything. Trump said U.S. troops and defense systems in South Korea did not make Americans safer. He said he could eliminate the nuclear threat on the peninsula simply by striking a deal with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. This is all about leader versus leader, man versus man, me versus Kim, he said. Trump proceeded to explain that NATO, too, was worthless. U.S. generals were letting the Allied member countries get away with murder, he said, and they owed the United States a lot of money after not living up to their promise of paying their dues. They're in arrears, Trump said, reverting to the language of real estate. He lifted both his arms at his sides in frustration. Then he scolded top officials for the untold millions of dollars he believed they had let slip through their fingers by allowing allies to avoid their obligations. We are owed money you haven't been collecting, Trump told them. You would go totally bankrupt if you had to run your own business. Mattis wasn't trying to convince the president of anything, only to explain and provide facts. Now things were devolving quickly. The general tried to calmly explain to the president that he was not quite right. The NATO allies didn't owe the United States back rent, he said. The truth was more complicated. NATO had a non-binding goal that members should pay at least 2% of their gross domestic product on their defenses. Only 5 of the countries currently met that goal, but it wasn't as if they were shorting the United States on the bill. More broadly, Mattis argued, the NATO alliance was not serving only to protect Western Europe. It protected America, too. This is what keeps us safe, Mattis said. Cohn tried to explain to Trump that he needed to see the value of the trade deals. These are commitments that help keep us safe, Cohn said. Bannon interjected. Stop, he said. All you guys talk about all these great things. They're all our partners. I want you to name me now one country and one company that's going to have his back. Trump then disputed every point Cohn had made advocating the benefits of existing trade agreements. Gary, I don't want to hear about free trade, Trump said. We're upside down. They're ripping us off. All the jobs are gone. They're ripping us off. The president added, I want reciprocal trade deals where it's balanced. I want these guys to start picking up the load. We can't keep doing this. Trump then repeated a threat he'd made countless times before. He wanted out of the Iran nuclear deal that President Obama had struck in 2015, which called for Iran to eliminate its uranium stockpile and cut its nuclear weaponry. It's the worst deal in history, Trump declared. Well, actually, Tillerson interjected. I don't want to hear it, Trump said, cutting off the Secretary of State before he could explain some of the benefits of the agreement. They're cheating. They're building. We're getting out of it. I keep telling you. I keep giving you time and you keep delaying me. I want out of it. Before they could debate the Iran deal, Trump erupted to revive another frequent complaint, the war in Afghanistan, which was now America's longest war. He demanded an explanation for why the United States hadn't won in Afghanistan yet, now 16 years after the nation began fighting there in the wake of the 9/11 terror attacks. Trump unleashed his disdain, calling Afghanistan a loser war. That phrase hung in the air and disgusted not only the military leaders at the table, but also the men and women in uniform sitting along the back wall behind their principals. They all were sworn to obey their commander-in-chief's commands, and here he was calling the war they had been fighting a loser war. You're all losers, Trump said. You don't know how to win anymore. Trump questioned why the United States couldn't get some oil as payment for the troops stationed in the Persian Gulf. We spent $7 trillion. They're ripping us off, Trump boomed. Where is the fucking oil? Trump seemed to be speaking up for the voters who elected him, and several attendees thought they heard Bannon in Trump's words. Bannon had been trying to persuade Trump to withdraw forces by telling him, the American people are saying we can't spend $1 trillion a year on this. We just can't. It's going to bankrupt us. And not just that, the deplorables don't want their kids in the South China Sea at the 38th parallel or in Syria, in Afghanistan, in perpetuity. Trump mused about removing General John Nicholson, the U.S. commander in charge of troops in Afghanistan. I don't think he knows how to win, the president said, impugning Nicholson, who was not present at the meeting. Dunford tried to come to Nicholson's defense, but the mild-mannered general struggled to convey his points to the irascible president. Mr. President, that's just not... Dunford started. We've been under different orders. Dunford sought to explain that he hadn't been charged with annihilating the enemy in Afghanistan, but was instead following a strategy started by the Obama administration to gradually reduce the military presence in the country in hopes of training locals to maintain a stable government so that eventually the United States could pull out. Trump shot back in more plain language. I want to win, he said. We don't win any wars anymore. We spend $7 trillion. Everybody else got the oil, and we're not winning anymore. Trump, by now, was in one of his rages. He was so angry that he wasn't taking many breaths. All morning, he had been coarse and cavalier, but the next several things he bellowed went beyond that description. They stunned nearly everyone in the room, and some vowed that they would never repeat them.
"I wouldn't go to war with you people,"
Trump told the assembled brass. Addressing the room, the commander-in-chief barked,
"You're a bunch of dopes and babies."
For a president known for verbiage he euphemistically called locker room talk, this was the gravest insult he could have delivered to these people in this sacred space. The flag officers in the room were shocked. Some staff began looking down at their papers, rearranging folders, almost wishing themselves out of the room. A few considered walking out. They tried not to reveal their revulsion on their faces, but questions raced through their minds. "How does the commander-in-chief say that?" one thought. "What would our worst adversaries think if they knew he said this?" This was a president who had been labeled a draft dodger for avoiding service in the Vietnam War under questionable circumstances. Trump was a young man born of privilege and in seemingly perfect health, 6'2", with a muscular build and a flawless medical record. He played several sports, including football. Then, in 1968, at age 22, he obtained a diagnosis of bone spurs in his heels that exempted him from military service, just as the United States was drafting men his age to fulfill massive troop deployments to Vietnam. Tillerson, in particular, was stunned by Trump's diatribe and began visibly seething. For too many minutes, others in the room noticed, he had been staring straight, dumbfounded, at Mattis, who was speechless, his head bowed down toward the table. Tillerson thought to himself, "Gosh darn it, Jim, say something. Why aren't you saying something?" But, as he would later tell close aides, Tillerson realized in that moment that Mattis was genetically a Marine, unable to talk back to his commander-in-chief, no matter what nonsense came out of his mouth. The more perplexing silence was from Pence, a leader who should have been able to stand up to Trump. Instead, one attendee thought, "He's sitting there, frozen like a statue. Why doesn't he stop the president?" Another recalled the vice president was a wax museum guy. From the start of the meeting, Pence looked as if he wanted to escape and put an end to the president's torrent. Surely, he disagreed with Trump's characterization of military leaders as dopes and babies, considering his son Michael was a Marine first lieutenant then training for his naval aviator wings. But some surmised Pence feared getting crosswise with Trump. "A total deer in the headlights," recalled a third attendee. Others at the table noticed Trump's stream of venom had taken an emotional toll. So many people in that room had gone to war and risked their lives for their country, and now they were being dressed down by a president who had not. They felt sick to their stomachs. Tillerson told others he thought he saw a woman in the room silently crying. He was furious and decided he couldn't stand it another minute. His voice broke into Trump's tirade, this one about trying to make money off U.S. troops. "No, that's just wrong," the Secretary of State said. "Mr. President, you're totally wrong. None of that is true." Tillerson's father and great-uncle had both been combat veterans, and he was deeply proud of their service. "The men and women who put on a uniform don't do it to become soldiers of fortune," Tillerson said. "That's not why they put on a uniform and go out and die. They do it to protect our freedom." There was silence in the tank. Several military officers in the room were grateful to the Secretary of State for defending them when no one else would. The meeting soon ended, and Trump walked out, saying goodbye to a group of servicemen lining the corridor as he made his way to his motorcade waiting outside. Mattis, Tillerson, and Cohn were deflated. Standing in the hall with a small cluster of people he trusted, Tillerson finally let down his guard. "He's a fucking moron," the Secretary of State said of the president. The plan by Mattis, Tillerson, and Cohn to train the president to appreciate the internationalist view had clearly backfired. "We were starting to get out on the wrong path, and we really needed to have a course correction and needed to educate, to teach, to help him understand the reason and basis for a lot of these things," said one senior official involved in the planning. "We needed to change how he thinks about this, to course correct. Everybody was on board, 100% agreed with that sentiment. But they were dismayed and in shock when not only did it not have the intended effect, but he dug in his heels and pushed it even further on the spectrum, further solidifying his views." A few days later, Pence's national security advisor, Andrea Thompson, a retired Army colonel who had served in Afghanistan and Iraq, reached out to thank Tillerson for speaking up on behalf of the military and the public servants who had been in the tank. By September, she would leave the White House and join Tillerson at Foggy Bottom as Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security Affairs. The tank meeting had so thoroughly shocked the conscience of military leaders that they tried to keep it a secret. At the Aspen Security Forum 2 days later, longtime NBC News correspondent Andrea Mitchell asked Dunford how Trump had interacted during the tank meeting. The Joint Chiefs chairman misleadingly described the meeting, skipping over the fireworks. "He asked a lot of hard questions, and the one thing he does is question some fundamental assumptions that we make as military leaders, and he will come in and question those," Dunford told Mitchell on July 22nd. "It's a pretty energetic and an interactive dialogue." One victim of the tank meeting was Trump's relationship with Tillerson, which forever after was strained. The Secretary of State came to see it as the beginning of the end. It would only worsen when news that Tillerson had called Trump a moron was reported in October by NBC News. The following weekend, Attorney General Jeff Sessions was back in the president's crosshairs. He was under scrutiny anew for his two 2016 conversations with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. On July 21st, The Washington Post reported that U.S. intelligence agencies had intercepted Kislyak's accounts of the conversations to his superiors in Moscow, telling them that he and Sessions had discussed matters related to the Trump campaign. This was important because Sessions had denied discussing the campaign with Kislyak. Again, the news coverage triggered a spasm of fury from Trump, who in conversations with advisors had called the attorney general fucking worthless, a fucking idiot, a fucking jerk-off, a fucking moron, and a fuckhead. Trump had been openly imitating Sessions' Alabama drawl and mocking him for being portrayed by a woman, Kate McKinnon, on Saturday Night Live. On July 22nd, Trump traveled to Newport News, Virginia, to attend the commissioning ceremony for the USS Gerald R. Ford, the Navy's newest battleship. Aboard Marine One, as they choppered onto the ship, Trump gave Reince Priebus an order. "We got to get rid of Jeff," Trump told his chief of staff. "You have to get his resignation, and don't give me any of this slow-me-down Reince bullshit either. You've got to get it." Trump told Priebus to write down his reason for forcing the attorney general's resignation. "The American people cannot withstand any more of this. referring to negative publicity. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and White House Senior Policy Advisor Stephen Miller, the former Sessions protege, both were on board the helicopter and said nothing to try to talk the president out of the rash action. At one point, Trump asked Mnuchin what he thought of removing Sessions, and Mnuchin told the president he agreed. Priebus was alone in trying to stop the president. On board the battleship, Priebus hovered backstage, calling White House counsel Don McGahn to figure out what he should do. He knew it would be disastrous to follow Trump's orders. Regardless, Jody Hunt, the Attorney General's chief of staff, had already told Priebus that Sessions would not quit and would have to be fired. So Priebus and McGahn decided to slow walk Trump. After the ceremony, Trump followed up with Priebus about the resignation letter. "Did you get it?" the president asked. Priebus persuaded Trump to hold off. The next day was Sunday, and he said the president would not want the ouster to dominate the Sunday political talk shows. "Let's deal with this tomorrow," Priebus told him. Trump relented. Over the next few days, Trump's complaints to other advisors about Priebus being too weak would reach a fever pitch. "If we heard it once, we heard it 20 times that week, this erosion of confidence," recalled a senior White House official. "The word was weak, 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 can't get it done." On Monday, July 24th, with no action taken against Sessions, Trump took to Twitter to vent. In a 7:49 a.m. missive, the president admonished our beleaguered AG. For Sessions and his aides, the tweet was devastating. Over the next 24 hours, the media were on Sessions' death watch. The next afternoon, shortly after 3, Trump strode out to the Rose Garden for a news conference. The Justice Department's senior leadership gathered in the Attorney General's office to watch on television. Sessions and his deputies thought he would use the occasion to announce his firing. The president called on Margaret Tolliver of Bloomberg News, who stood up to ask her question. "Your kind of catchphrase or motto before the White House was, 'You're fired.' So I'm wondering if you would talk to us a little bit about whether you've lost confidence in Jeff Sessions, whether you want him to resign on his own, whether you're prepared to fire him if he doesn't, and why you're sort of letting him twist in the wind rather than just making the call for him." Watching on television, Sessions was calm. He leaned back in his desk chair as if he were watching a football game. Hunt had his hand over his mouth. Rachel Brand, the department's number 3, who was considered a possible successor, focused intently. Noel Francisco, the Solicitor General, held his hand to his head. And the Attorney General's spokeswoman, Sarah Isker Flores, and Legislative Affairs Chief Stephen Boyd both leaned forward in anticipation of what the president would say. "Well, I don't think I am doing that, but I am disappointed in the Attorney General," Trump said. "He should not have recused himself almost immediately after he took office. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me prior to taking office, and I would have quite simply picked somebody else. So I think that's a bad thing, not for the president, but for the presidency. I think it's unfair to the presidency, and that's the way I feel." Sessions had survived to live another day. But in the days that followed, he and his aides made plans for a Saturday Night Massacre, a reference to the series of Justice Department resignations triggered by President Nixon's 1973 order that his attorney general fire the Watergate independent special prosecutor. They prepared for several scenarios. If Trump fired Sessions, if Trump fired Rosenstein, and if Trump ordered the firing of Mueller. Senior officials considered whether they would resign too, and some had even drafted resignation letters. For instance, Hunt later told the special counsel that Sessions prepared a resignation letter during this period and for the rest of the year carried it in his pocket every time he visited the White House. At times, aides joked that the planning for a Saturday night massacre resembled 1950s nuclear drills. Get under your desk. Duck. Cover. Rosenstein warned the White House that the Justice Department building would effectively clear out within an hour of any such move by Trump. His objective was to instill fear of a mass exodus that could be politically crippling for the president. Secretly, however, Rosenstein and the team developed a different plan. Whether to stay or quit was dependent on each person's conscience, of course. But it was important to Rosenstein that enough senior people remain in their jobs to protect the Justice Department and the integrity of the special counsel investigation. He and his team warned Brand to constantly be ready to assume control at a moment's notice. If Trump named her acting attorney general, the plan was for Brand to hold a news conference within 45 minutes to reassure public confidence in the probe. Rosenstein told Brand around this time that there was a good chance he would get fired, and if she took over the Russia investigation, the most important thing to do would be to buy herself time and to not act immediately on any White House orders. He said she should consult right away with the three officials under him who were up to speed on the probe. It's under control, he told Brand. It's not a witch hunt. It's not a fishing expedition. We're monitoring it closely. We're meeting with Mueller's team every other week. If I get fired, my advice to you is, whatever they tell you, tell them I need time to sort this all out. On July 24th, Sessions and Priebus were not the only advisors to draw Trump's attention. Jared Kushner publicly defended his 2016 meeting with the Russian lawyer at Trump Tower, saying, I did not collude with Russia, and insisting that all of his actions during the campaign were proper. Because Kushner's appearance in the West Wing driveway was his first on-camera press statement, it was covered as major news, and the president tuned in. Jared looks like a little boy, Trump told other advisors. Ever since the Trump Tower meeting story broke on July 8th, Trump had been feeling sorry for his daughter Ivanka and Kushner. He thought they were being unfairly maligned in the news media, and he feared they could suffer from Mueller's glare. He was convinced they were being targeted not for their own misdeeds or failures of judgment, but because they were members of his family. You guys should have never come here, Trump told Ivanka and Kushner around this time, in the presence of other White House advisors. You see what kind of a mess this is? You're getting killed. Why would you come here? There's a better life back in New York. I don't understand why you want to stay here. July 24th turned out to be an eventful Monday for Trump. He flew to Mount Hope, West Virginia, to address the annual Boy Scout Jamboree. Some 40,000 boys, ranging in age from 12 to 18, assembled under the hot summer sun to hear inspiring words from their president. On stage in West Virginia, Trump described Washington as a cesspool, attacked President Obama, trashed Hillary Clinton, threatened to fire Secretary of Health and Human Services Tom Price, lambasted the fake news media, mocked pollsters, and told a meandering tale about a famous home builder who frequented the Manhattan cocktail party circuit and engaged in interesting activities aboard his yacht, which he left to the boys' imaginations. Should I tell you? Trump asked, teasing the crowd. Oh, you're Boy Scouts, but you know life. You know life. As Trump rambled off script, speaking for 35 minutes in total, his aides cringed. Standing at attention behind him were two former Boy Scouts in his cabinet, Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke and Secretary of Energy Rick Perry. But two others, Tillerson and Sessions, were not included on the trip. Zinke wore a scouting uniform, which White House aides mocked as a Smokey the Bear costume and said made the former Navy SEAL look absurd. At one point in his remarks, Trump reflected on Boy Scout values, saying, "As the Scouts Law says, a Scout is trustworthy, loyal. We could use some more loyalty, I will tell you that." The boys then chanted 10 other attributes in Boy Scout law: helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. But the president did not easily embody a single one. The head of the Boy Scouts of America later apologized to scouting families who were offended by the president's comments. 4 days later, July 28th, Trump provoked similar outrage from his critics when he addressed a gathering of law enforcement officers at Suffolk County Community College in New York. The president used stark language in describing the violent transnational gang MS-13 to effectively approve of police brutality in combating illegal immigration. He said, "When police throw these thugs into the backs of paddy wagons, please don't be too nice. When you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over, like, don't hit their head, and they just killed somebody? Don't hit their head," Trump said. He mimed an officer shielding a suspect's head from hitting the police vehicle. "I said, you can take the hand away, okay?" A number of police officers attending Trump's event chuckled and applauded. The scene led the Suffolk County Police Department to distance itself by tweeting, "We do not and will not tolerate roughing up of prisoners." In Washington, Chuck Rosenberg, the acting administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration, watched the speech with horror. The career prosecutor, already disgusted by Trump's treatment of his friend Jim Comey, felt he had to say something to make clear that law enforcement agents would reject the president's course proposal. Rosenberg sent an all-staff memo to DEA personnel mentioning Trump's remarks and assuring them he trusted they would continue to respect defendants' rights and conduct themselves with integrity. The president, in remarks delivered yesterday in New York, condoned police misconduct regarding the treatment of individuals placed under arrest by law enforcement, Rosenberg's memo said. "So why do I write? I write to offer a strong reaffirmation of the operating principles to which we, as law enforcement professionals, adhere. I write because we have an obligation to speak out when something is wrong." "You know you can't do that," Rosenstein, who oversaw the DEA administrator at the Justice Department, told Rosenberg after reading his email. Rosenberg was a career employee, not an appointee, so Trump could not summarily fire him. Still, his position was untenable. Rosenberg would stay at the DEA a while longer and announce his resignation on September 26, 2017. On the flight home on July 28th from Long Island after his rough-em-up speech to cops, Trump roughed up one of his own in humiliating fashion. When Air Force One touched down at Joint Base Andrews early that Friday evening, while most of his staffers deplaned, the president stayed in his cabin and pecked out a tweet. "I am pleased to inform you that I have just named General/Secretary John F. Kelly as White House Chief of Staff." Priebus, who had been on board, was fired. Just like that. Priebus walked across the tarmac in the drenching rain and tucked into a black government SUV, which ferried him off alone separate from the presidential motorcade, with no fanfare. Minutes later, when Trump stepped off the plane, he shouted at reporters from beneath a giant umbrella, "Reince is a good man." Trump had had his eyes on Kelly for a while. After firing Comey in May, the president had asked Kelly to be FBI director. Kelly had declined, saying he preferred to stay as Homeland Security Secretary, but he had observed to Trump that he had been poorly served by his staff because they had let him fire the FBI director without a plan B. That conversation stuck with Trump, and the last week of July, he asked Kelly to step in as chief of staff. Kelly asked to take the weekend to consider the offer, but the president was too impatient. He tweeted Kelly's appointment before he had agreed to take the job. Priebus had been in an impossible position. Despite tireless efforts, he never could manage to assert control over basic White House functions, such as communications and policy development, in large part because of the president's impulses. Trump never fully empowered Priebus either, allowing Bannon, Kushner, and Ivanka to operate as independent forces outside the chief of staff's authority. Priebus complained to friends that he often felt demeaned by the president's treatment of him. Trump had undermined Priebus by calling him Reincey. When they flew to Priebus's hometown of Kenosha, Wisconsin, for an April manufacturing event, the chief of staff peered out the window of Air Force One and spotted his home down below. The president mocked him for it. These episodes illustrated what some of Trump's subordinates considered his cruelty as a manager. He was willing, eager, really, to belittle the people working for him.